Dave?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey! What's going on?
Great to hear your voice. Been looking forward to this for a while.
Awesome. Me too. You have no idea.
Maybe a little bit.
Well, I've been doing this for a while now, for a little over a year now.
Yep. You've been real productive.
Yeah. So I've done over 50 interviews. And I don't know how many of them you've heard, but a bunch of them have mentioned you.
That's great. I've listened to quite a few when I first heard from you back in May, June. And what a great, I want to say blast from the past, but it was more than that and just precipitated a lot of great memories and kind of revelations about how that era has really shaped how a lot of us are today. Been cool.
Yeah, that's a lot of what I wanted to talk about with you, because you know your career has gone in such an interesting direction from where you started in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm kind of curious about how that started and how growing up in Reston kind of shaped that for you.
Yeah, that's a great starting point. And I feel like I've gotten a few months of time to really reflect on that, as well as listen to what some of my good friends and fellow musicians from that era have had to say, mostly Pat Kennedy and Brian Stewart and Andre Love. I listened to all of their interviews with a lot of attention to detail. And I think one of the things that really comes out of that, and Pat said it really well, was we grew up in the suburbs. We were all, by 21st century terms, as you know, fairly privileged in terms of our basic setup. Of course, that varied a lot from neighborhood to neighborhood and person to person. But what I think being involved with the music scene there in the 80s really taught a lot of us is what Pat and you have referred to as the do-it-yourself mentality. And for me, it's I would unpack that a little bit more, and it really taught us empowerment. We lived at a time when the cool music that we were into was really hard to access, and we had to be really motivated to make that happen. You know, there was one record store in Georgetown, and that was a long way for us when we were 14, 15, 16 years old, and then just kind of gathering the resources to be able to make music. Some other folks have spoken to some of the crazy contraptions we set up to make it happen. But that's really what it was all about, is figuring out how to make stuff happen, be resourceful, keep it simple, and a lot of the essence of hardcore is really all about those things. Simplicity, keeping it basic, being honest, and being straight up. And when I hear about what other folks are up to now, we've all done such different things, but that piece is consistent.
Well, let me ask you, you talked about empowerment. Did you feel at all disempowered?
Well, you mean back then?
Yeah. That you needed something like this to empower you.
Yeah, you know, looking back on it now, I think many of us can probably see that we had a lot going for us. But at the time, you know, Reagan was president. The economy was booming, but at a cost that we all were attentive to, even at that young age. And it just seemed like society was headed hell or high water in the direction of growth at the expense of human cultures and the planet and a lot of things that maybe we didn't even know we loved or cared about then. But we had a knack for a feeling that things were headed in a direction that we didn't want to go. And the way we dealt with that in our own different ways, as well as our own you know, family situations and social situations, and we were misfits in the mainstream of Reston back then, was to make music and play these shows. And I think you definitely know that the shows and the music were what gave us hope, what saved us, what kept us moving forward, and kind of shaped a lot of our artistic abilities and ethos and ethics today. So it was like a big coping, like a collective cultural coping strategy for what was happening in the world and in our lives.
So what came first for you? Was it guitar? Was it writing? Was it art? Because you did all of those things, you know, and have done all of those things in your life. Was there one particular thing that you discovered first?
It's probably art in terms of, you know, visual art, drawing, and working with other kind of simple media. Singing and writing lyrics and poetry came a little bit later, and I was really inspired by my peers at that time. And then learning to actually play instruments for me came relatively late, like many folks have weighed in. I think Jerry Barrett talked about this quite a bit in his interview. The guitar lab class at South Lakes High School was where a lot of us either learned to play guitar or got a lot better. So for me, that came in like junior year, 17 years old, whereas a lot of the guys I was playing music with, they'd been playing instruments since they were 12, 13, 14.
Although somebody told me that that you guys went to camp together, and maybe you were messing around on guitar at summer camp and had shown them some things on guitar.
Yeah, that probably would have been Soren. He and I both went to this, it was a church camp up in the mountains of Virginia. It was hardcore in its own way. You wouldn't think, but if you take the elements of kind of simplicity, honesty, and expression of the basic human experience, all that happened at camp. We were playing music all the time. We were in the outdoors, which is about as simple an environment as you can be in. And yeah, come to think of it, there were acoustic guitars going around. And that, for me, was probably one of the origin points of unplugging and bringing it down to the even more basic medium of acoustic instruments. Because when you're at camp, you're living in cabins and you're not plugged in. But I remember hanging out with Soren and some of the other folks at camp there and playing tunes. It was great.
When did you first start, you know, playing electric and singing with anybody else?
It was the first band that I was in is one of the, I think, most underground bands in Reston. We were called Knothead, and it was myself on vocals, Terry Marquez on the bass, Tom Z on guitar, and Carter Blitch on the drums, and of course, of the four of us, Carter has gone on to do some pretty amazing things with JFK and other stuff. But that was my first attempt at vocals, and I was really inspired by Pat. He and I were, as you know, really close, and I watched what he did with Hostile Environment, and I was just so impressed and blown away by his ability to make stuff happen. I was like, gosh, I don't mean it the wrong way, but I was like, gosh, if Pat can just get up there and sing and write these songs, and I should probably do that too, or something like it, because it inspired in me the idea that we all have these latent talents and ways of expressing ourselves, and we just need to let it rip.
And so what was your experience in Knothead?
We had a great time. We practiced in Carter's basement, and you've heard probably lots of stories like this, but Carter got his drum kit from Ben Rosenquist, who was the drummer for Hostile Environment. hospital environment was, they were probably a full year ahead of us in terms of how long they'd been together and making songs and playing shows. So I don't know if Ben got a new drum kit. He probably did. And Carter bought his old drum kit. And everybody knew that finding a good drummer was like the hardest part. And Carter had a drum kit, and he had a lot of motivation to learn. So he was able to play the basic hardcore rhythms, cut times and 4/4s and stuff pretty quickly. I don't remember exactly how it happened, how we got together, but we did, and we were, I think that was in 1987. And we quick, like many of us did, we quickly wrote a quiver of tunes, you know, enough to play a half hour or 40 minute set, and started playing shows. Played garage shows. We played every opportunity we could. We did a four-track recording in Carter's basement with Spooky, with Alan, and we produced a demo. I think we made 100 copies and sold them for $4, and those are all gone. I don't even have one of those. But it was a great formative experience, and as you may know, Hostile Environment broke up somewhere around that time, maybe in 88. A year was a long time back then, and there was an opportunity for some reformation, and at that time, I think Tom Zeedy and myself took the opportunity and grouped up with Pat and Jason Radley to form, and Andre to form Remission, and Carter and Terry went on to do their own different music thing. I don't remember what their band was called. But they went on to continue to write tunes and play together for a while.
Did you do any of the artwork back then on the four-track tape? Was that you?
Yeah, that was my illustration, the kind of warped skull with the rope tied around its jaw and its head, and that was my stuff.
That's cool. And you did the art for Remission too, right, for Fix?
Yeah, as well as several of the Jam for Man flyers and T-shirts. That was, the early ones were mostly myself and San Vistos, who was another very close friend back then.
So did that feel good, like seeing your art get out there and seeing people wearing, you know, T-shirts with your stuff on it?
Yeah, I guess it did. I'm sure it did at the time. It just kind of felt like what we were up to, though. And I don't remember having like a big swelled feeling of pride about that. It was just part of what we were all doing and part of the experience together.
Well, so let me talk about your vocals for a second, because
sure.
I think that you have one of the great rock screams from Reston.
That's great.
I love your vocals best when you are kind of, you know, really, really bringing that,
mm-hmm.
And really just sort of shouting at the top of your lungs. That's my favorite.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
When did you discover that you could do that? Was that something that came before you joined the band, or was that something that you discovered, like,
think the latter, really. I was, you know, the music that I was listening to was Minor Threat, 7 Seconds, other kind of more obscure bands like Verbal Assault. They were from out of Rhode Island. They played a lot in D.C. And then the rest in the scene, I mean, we were hugely influenced by our own scene. So I was listening to Pat Kennedy and Andy Wells and Brian Stewart, and they screamed a lot. What I would call, you know, kind of the growling screaming. So that's just kind of what we did. And the thing that came later for me was pulling it back and trying to sing a tune a little bit more, which took a while. But other folks were starting to do that too, and a lot of the music we listened to, Kevin Seconds certainly did that admirably. So I just kind of, I think like a lot of us, I was influenced by music I was listening to and the people around me, and synthesized that, and eventually you keep doing that, and eventually you end up original, sounding not as much like other people and more like something new. In terms of the rest in the scene, I always admired Andy's voice, Andy Wells' voice with LDK. I mean, he just belted it out. It was straight up. There was nothing contrived about it. So I paid attention to the way he did things.
Remission was a very different sounding band, though, than the rest of the rest in the scene. I mean, I would say that Knothead was much more straight ahead, hardcore. Like the other rest in hardcore, but Remission was something very different from that.
Yeah, that's for sure. As other folks have commented on, yeah, Knothead was hardcore, and Remission had all of these other kind of more sophisticated musical influences that were really enabled by the talent of the musicians. And that was Jason Radley and Andre Love. I mean, by the time Remission got together, those guys were coming into new territory. Well, Andre had probably been there for a while, but Jason's ability to arrange complex songs was increasing. He was being influenced by everything from jazz to, you know, classic rock. Andre was just an unstoppable rhythmic force, but also he had a lot to offer in terms of general ear and feel for the tunes. And Pat couldn't be underestimated either. Pat did a lot of writing of the songs and the riffs that we put together for the Fix cassette.
Who came up with Watch Me Now?
That was, I forget which one of us. I think Pat talked a little bit about how we wrote songs. At the time, it seemed perfectly normal, and it didn't occur to me that other bands had one person who was the primary songwriter. In our case, it wasn't really that way at all. We went into the basement, and, you know, Pat would have a riff, and I would have some lyrics and maybe a melody line idea. And then Jason would have some riffs, and he would say, let's see if we can modulate that and put it in a different key and make it work with your riff. And, oh, it could be cool if we go from this really minor-y sound, as the beginning of Watch Me Now is, to this major, like, sing-songy chorus. And Andre was, as well as writing really amazing drum parts for all of this, he had a lot to say about transitions and how the songs kind of hung together. I was probably the least musically talented of the group, and my job was just to come up with cool lyrics and good melody lines and choruses and scream a lot. It was great.
Well, Pat's bass line on that track is undeniable.
Yeah.
It's such a great bass part. And
yeah.
The song itself, you know, I mean, albeit recorded, you know, in a very four track kind of way, you know, the song is there.
Yeah.
Like that is a catchy as hell song.
Yeah.
Was that your experience when you played it for people, when you played it live, that was the one that people knew or stuck with them?
Yeah, for sure. There were a few songs that we had like that, and it was always changing. Like, we'd play a show and everybody would know and be into Watch Me Now, and then we'd play another show and it would be moving again, and I'm not never quite sure about how that happened. Certainly producing the cassette enabled people to really learn the songs who maybe weren't able to go to all the shows. But Watch Me Now always was kind of a classic, and one that when we were writing a set list, we were pretty intentional about where we put that and how we transitioned into it. And because it was one of our first songs, we produced a four-track demo in the Silva's basement before Fix. It was a predecessor to Fix by over a year. And that song was on that four-track. The four-track was, we never produced it and sold it, but we circulated it around. So it was one of the songs that we wrote in our first few months together, and we played it consistently long enough that people knew it well.
Out the breath. The breath taken in over 1,000 years or so it seems. But so even my attempt to conceal these tears
don't watch me now.
Well, as the tide rolls in and cover the years,
I'll
call
you friend.
But a separation brings the source of these fears.
Out the breath.
Generally, just great. A lot of positive power coming out of those events. My favorite ones were the earliest ones, but there were sweet spots in some of the later ones that I was involved with as well. One of the fondest memories I have is just of Patty Worsler and Bob Dim. I mean, those guys were like hardcore bodhisattvas for us. They just set us up and we're really invested in channeling our energy in a positive direction. There were other key players. Brian Stewart and Joe Banks were very instrumental in making those shows happen and successful. It was a real honor to be able to play those shows and play them with those bands that we love so much. The one that I remember the most was, I think it was the first one at the Reston Community Center. Maybe it wasn't the first, but it was the first one that Remission played at the Reston Community Center. And I think Brian alluded to this in his interview. There were hundreds of people there, and we didn't expect that. We had really had no idea how word would spread by word of mouth. But there was such power in the presence of all those people. And, you know, because of the fire code, all the whole Hunterswood Shopping Center around the community center was flooded with hardcore people who were there for the music and the mission. And we were just blown away. I mean, I think it really put wind in the sail of the rest of the scene like probably nothing else had before.
And do you remember watching the other bands at those shows also?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very, very vividly. And there were so many of them that I would have to do some real memory probing to bring it all back. But for me, the big bands that I just really loved through all of those years were LDK and Avail. And Davis White's band, I say his band because he's the one of them that I knew the most, Repercussion, they blew me away as well. They were doing something much different and much more kind of sophisticated in terms of songwriting and arrangements. And it's one of the, that was one of the few cassettes, Repercussion, that I kept and had until a couple of years ago when it probably got eaten by one of my old tape decks. But I still listen to that.
Well, so after that, after playing the Jam for Man, what sort of became of Remission, and what were you thinking in terms of music, or what was like the next step for you?
Yeah, I was in three bands in the scene: Knothead first, Remission second, and then finally Avail. But by then, Avail was in Richmond, and that's kind of a whole other era. But for me, Remission was like the band that I identified with the most, that I felt was kind of like not my band, but when I look back at that time, that's the music that occupies the most kind of space in my head and heart. And a lot of it had to do with the four of us. I thought a lot about all the bands and the different lineups that they had. And for us, the quad of Jason, Pat, myself, and Andre, it was just so creative and so positive. A lot of growing up and being a teenager and figuring out how to get along with people, and that was the demise of a lot of bands in Reston. That's cool, you know, it just led to other things. But we all got along really well. We didn't hang out 24/7 after hours and things like that, but in terms of a working group, it was just awesome. So when I think Pat talked about this in his interview, when it came time, the question of whether who was going to college or not, that was myself and Jason. And I didn't think I was at first, and I didn't want to. But then I went and visited a couple of colleges, and I was like, wow, I can just go live in some cool place and learn about what I want instead of what people are telling me. And this could be a really cool thing. So I decided to do it, and that was a turning point for the band.
Says the guy who, like, spent the rest of his life there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm still in college, right, as a professor. So it was obvious that Pat and Andre both wanted to continue to make music. So as you know, we did a little swap. Avail was kind of going through a similar transition, and Pat went to Avail, and DJ Grimes came to us and became our bass player. And DJ was a really talented, amazing bass player with a little bit more of a kind of funk punk influence. than Pat had had. Pat was coming more from straight hardcore. So that, you know, changed things, and it changed things socially as well, because in terms of, you know, my deepest relationship with the band was with Pat. So when Pat left the band, I was happy to work with DJ. He was an amazing bass player, and we continued to play some great shows and even wrote some new tunes with DJ on the bass that were good tunes. But having Pat go to the Veil was a big loss. And I there was a twang in my heart, because I was like, well, I kind of want to follow Pat, because really I'd followed Pat's lead all those years. But it wasn't going to go that way. So Remission kept playing tunes and playing shows until we graduated. And then we did a couple of reunion shows later, where we actually went back to the original lineup. I don't remember why, if DJ had moved away or what. But after Jason and I went to college, we came back and we played a few more shows with the original lineup of Remission. And those were really some of our best shows. We wrote new parts and new transitions between the songs. And I couldn't help but feeling, God, if this band had five more years, we would just be, the sky would be the limit in terms of what we could write and do together.
Well, it could have.
Could have, should have, would have, right?
So a lot of people, I don't think, even know that you were the lead singer with Avail for a brief amount of time.
Yeah.
How did that come together, and, you know, how do you feel about having been the lead singer of Avail?
It was a great experience. You know, when Avail moved to Richmond, the whole kind of feel of what they were up to shifted, because the environment shifted. And Richmond was a much more urban scene, had a little bit more edge to it. As you're familiar with the story of why Brian didn't want to go do that. So I was down at college in Florida, and I got a phone call from Joe Banks. And Joe is another person who I had great admiration for. Was a real leader in the scene and just boundless in his creativity and his generosity as well. He was always very supportive of what the other bands were up to, particularly Remission. So when I got that call from Joe, it was like a dream call. And college wasn't that great, and it was cool, but it wasn't as great as, you know, going and playing with Avail. So I quit school. And this is in fall of 90. And in January of 91, I moved into the Grace Street house with the rest of the band members, as well as a few other folks. Bobo was there, and some other people as well. I think there were eight of us in the house. And Joe had been sending me instrumental demos and some demos with him on vocals of some of the new songs that they've been writing. And I learned the parts, and plugged right into it. And we spent basically that whole spring learning songs, refining songs. We probably played half a dozen or a dozen shows in Richmond and in Reston, maybe a few other places in between. And we had a good thing going. This was Tim Berry on the drums, Joe on guitar, Pat on bass, and me singing. But for me, the magic was Avail ensconced in Reston and the interrelationships that we all had there. And I think I have ended up having some similar sentiments to Brian, in that that was really like the cradle and the hub of what we were up to. And Joe and Tim particularly were really interested in staying in Richmond and making, kind of developing that scene. And they knew that they had a real good opportunity there. And they were right on about that. But my interests were also shifting. I very clearly did not want to live in a city. I wanted to spend more time outside. I wanted to travel. So ultimately, there was a parting of ways there that it was okay. You know, there were no arguments or fights about it. But I think it was a big drag for Joe and Tim, because they were just trying to get liftoff. And here was this guy who came in and who was excited about it and then kind of turned around and said, no, I really don't want to do this. So hats off to them. They put it back together with Eric and on the drums and Tim singing and Chuck McCauley on bass and eventually Gwamper. And they went on to do, as you know, amazing things. And by the time they produced Over the James, I think they just had reached such an apex as a rested, inspired, kind of Richmond, fully matured hardcore band. But I would say that CD is an iconic and classic piece of hardcore music from the 90s that is kind of a masterpiece.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's still getting recognition, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah, I listen to it still. I've got a copy of it on my counter right now, the actual CD. And I sing along, and I sing harmony parts, and, you know, just go right with it. It's great.
So where did you go after that?
Well, at a road trip, we basically quit the band, went back to Reston, worked for the summer, saved up money, converted this old Dodge Colt Vista van that Pat's dad kind of donated to us. It was not quite on its last legs, but about there. And we took off. We had some good friends named Tasha and TW who had done a big road trip out west, and they came back all starry-eyed. And we've been reading Kerouac and stuff, and we were like, we got to go do this or we're not going to feel complete. So we hit the road, and we visited family and friends, and then eventually started exploring national parks and backpacking and all that. And that was in fall of 91. And Pat spoke to this in his interview. We got out to, by the time we got to Colorado, Pat was pretty clear he needed to come home. He had a relationship and some other things that were just drawing him back, and he wasn't having a very good time out there. And I was totally headed in the other direction. I was like, I'm going to Arizona, New Mexico, I'm going to get a motorcycle, this is awesome. And that was that.
Well, so that was that with Pat, but did you go, did you ever get that motorcycle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I worked with carpentry with my uncle in Albuquerque. Got $400, bought a 76 Honda CB750, beat up, took it apart, put it back together, do it yourself, make it happen, and just kept going.
And so you wound up kind of in the mountains at some point, at like higher elevation. That sort of became your thing, right?
Yeah, eventually. There's another part of the story. I went back to college in Florida in 91 and formed a band with some folks I knew there called Sunhead. And it was an amazing band with some real talent involved. I was the main songwriter and on guitar, and we had a second guitarist, bass player, and drummer. And the bass player and the drummer were tight and incredible musicians. And we kind of started another scene there in St. Augustine. And by the end of 2 years, we'd gone from there being two bands to there being about 12 bands. And it was this amazing kind of sub-replication of what had happened in Reston. Of course, there can only be one originator. But it was great to see that happening again there. We produced two recordings and made demo tapes, kind of the usual cassettes. We worked with Jim DeVito, who was an amazing engineer who had done stuff with Tom Petty and Don Henley and stuff like that. And he just loved us. I look at it like a lot of us left Reston, but we started other things, and we took some of the spirit of that and kept it going. So that went on for about 3 years, and then eventually I moved out to Arizona and spent the next 14 years out there doing other things, including music. But that's how I ended up. That's probably what you're thinking of. That's how I ended up out west and spending a lot of time in the mountains and such.
Well, didn't you wind up in California and the Sierra Nevadas at some point too?
And... yeah, I lived in Arizona, but I spent several months a year in the wilderness of the Sierra Nevada. Ended up doing graduate work there in alpine ecology and geomorphology, and then teaching long wilderness programs there, where we would basically disappear into the backcountry with our backpacks and learn about the natural world and expedition skills and things like that for entire summers. It was great.
What did you discover kind of up there in the mountains that you didn't have down below?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think about the kind of basics of hardcore and what that's really all about. And I think we all take it in kind of different directions. For me, as I mentioned, it was about simplicity, back to the basics, being empowered, not going with the mainstream, and just basically self-actualizing at the time through music and all of that. But there's a lot of transferability of that to other parts of our lives. So for me, getting spending more time in remote wild places is really an extension of that, getting even further back to the basic kind of condition of being human without a lot of stuff. I mean, when you're out there, it's just you and your pack and a small group of friends or students, but, you know, you're kind of like a little tribe out there. And there's a sense of purposefulness and peace and quiet that comes from that, that it's strangely similar to being behind the mic with your bandmates at a garage show in 1987 at some party when some folks' parents are out of town. There's just like you're exactly where you need to be, doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing.
Well, in terms of writing, you know, you've now written, how many books is it? Four books?
It depends on how you look at it. I published three books with mainstream publishers, and then I did one. The most recent thing I did was kind of Reston style. I went rogue, wasn't happy with what publishers were doing, and just produced my own really nice linen cloth hardbound book that I only give away. Talk about getting back to the basics. You can't buy it. You can't find it anywhere. I just give it away to people. And that's kind of coming full circle, back to giving away demo tapes that we recorded in the basement, you know?
Well, how do you compare the writing process and the creating a book to, you know, the projects of putting on a big show or, you know, or putting together an album or a band?
Well, there are certainly a lot of similarities in terms of having a vision and going with that and engaging in the creative process and being resourceful and kind of making a product happen that can be shared with others. But there's some real important differences too. I mean, writing books is for most of us can be very isolating. That can be a real benefit. You know, you're just getting into your groove and your solo creative process. But that's probably the biggest difference is, you know, music is a different type of production that involves a lot of collaboration and relationships. And that's probably what I miss most when I'm doing book writing.
In terms of your teaching, you have probably a lot of students that are that same age, you know, that were sort of talking about when you were in Richmond or in Florida?
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, most of the students are anywhere from 18 to 40. We've got some older students I work with that are a little older as well.
What do you try to, you know, pass on to them that you learned from that time, or that you can sort of relate to in terms of their experiences also? What are, what are the things that you see in them and try to help them with?
Well, you know, on one level, there's the subject matter of whatever you're teaching. And I teach botany and geology. I also teach expedition skills. I teach a course on flowering plants. You know, so there's what's happening at that level, kind of the content. But the deeper thing that most of my classes are with 8 to 12 students. So they're really small groups, and there's a lot of personalized relationship that happens there. And the deeper message is really about hardcore values. It's about how to keep things simple, how to self-actualize and make things happen, how to be a kind of driving force for positivity in the world, those kind of things. That's the secret sauce. That's what keeps people coming.
Do you see hope in terms of, geologically, in terms of that generation that you're teaching right now, or are you struggling with where the planet is and what you see happening?
Well, I think we all, I don't know if we all do, but there's certainly times when it's hard to look around and say, oh, this is really headed in a positive direction. But that's where I think just sticking to being peaceful and purposeful with what you're doing is really important. I mean, ultimately, and this goes way back to our original days as teenagers playing hardcore music, we didn't really have the expectation that the world was going to change according to our values. We just needed an opportunity to express who we were and what we were experiencing. And some of that carries over now. Like, you know, there's a lot of people in the world. People are consuming more than ever before. Other species are dropping out of the scene more quickly than we have any record or comparability with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in terms of, I don't put a lot of stock in hope for the human condition as it is right now. I don't think that there's a lot there. But I do put a lot of stock in continuing to lead purposeful lives, be positive forces for good in the world. And, of course, that varies depending on who you are. Being loving, kind people. And a lot of those values really go back to, you know, me and Pat and Brian Stewart having conversations at South Lake Center parking lot with our skateboards.
So you're continuing to make music. You know, up on your website, there's three whole albums of tunes that you've recorded, and you've probably recorded even more than that. How did that come about in terms of, like, recording those? And, you know, I just got to say your guitar skills have really come along and blossomed.
I think that really started with Reston again. And then when I lived at the Gray Street house in Richmond, you know, Joe worked full-time. I think he was a driver for UPS at the time, and I didn't. I'd quit school, so I had all day. And Joe had a four-track and little setup in his room that we were all free to use. So I basically hung out in there all day, every day, and wrote acoustic songs with my six-string and Joe's 12-string and overdubbed vocal harmonies and little melodies and leads, and really learned a lot about layering and texture and how to sing a tune and harmonize and things like that. So that was a formative time, and that was part of what made me realize I didn't want to be plugged into the wall that much anymore. So everything that I did after that was kind of pared down, and in some ways there's been a musical devolution back to just playing, you know, basically a guitar is like a wooden box with what used to be like animal guts stretched across these bones, right? And, you know, it's kind of evolved from there. So I just was increasingly intrigued by the idea of making very spare, simple music with minimal technology, and just kept doing that. I played, when I was out in Arizona, I played out with a couple of different outfits. One band was called Home, and we are all acoustic, all live. We did one recording in a studio, but it was kind of a live all-at-once recording by choice. And we played together for several years and played a lot with other musicians out there.
Tell of coming days, of earth to shake beneath the rising waves, of an age of a changing time, blessed the land that you would ever find. We went walking to finally see the holy places of our last life's journey. I prayed to God to watch over me and these humble pilgrims of my wandering company.
I've been living here, which has been 14 years now, it's mostly been solo stuff. So those more recent recordings, basically I'm tracking and doing, you know, a lead guitar or a mandolin riff or a second vocal track or whatever. And it's just fun. It's just a lot of fun. And I love sharing the music for free and not having any business or success or anything like that associated with it.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. If you're going when the snowflakes storm, rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds. Please see for me that her hair is hanging long, rolls and flows all down her breast. Please see for me that her hair is hanging. That's the way I remember her best.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're still making music.
And yeah, thanks.
I think other people that haven't, you know, continued to follow what you've been doing hopefully they'll get a chance to hear this and discover your new music and some of your writing also, and be able to keep up with what you've been doing artistically, because you've certainly been busy and continuing to live as an artist. Very much.
Yeah, so. That's real nice to hear, Andy. Thanks.
No, it's true. And like you said, like, it seems like as much as anybody, you have maintained those hardcore values and are putting that into everything that you do.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded of when I listened to Brian Stewart's interview. He kind of described the Reston scene in the 80s as imploding. And when I listened to that, I sat back and I thought about it, and I was like, I think maybe some of that happened, but it also exploded, you know, like, and fragments of it went out to Richmond, Virginia, and they certainly went with me wherever I went. And the kind of the nucleus of it was never as big or consolidated as it seemed to be when we were all doing that in the 80s. But a lot of us are out there, and some folks still in Reston, Brian in particular, Andre, still making music, still spreading the message of positivity and simplicity and all that stuff. And it's great. I think that was an explosive scene, not an implosive one.